Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase.
There's a lot to say when buying a new home or car, but only one thing to say that can help you protect them. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. And just like that, a State Farm agent will be there to help you choose the coverage you need, no matter where you are in life. When you need coverage options, your State Farm agent is there to help, on the phone or in person. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
I see you found the Nerdist podcast number 315. My voice is a little scratchy at the end of a long day of recording a lot of podcasts and talking loudly, because that's what I do. So when it gets like this, I like to do this voice a little bit because it sounds really crusty. This is a Nerdist podcast, a lot of live shows and shit coming up, so go to a computer. Nerdist.com/calendar. Alright, I'm done with this character. I've already annoyed myself. A lot of fun stuff. The YouTube channel, youtube.com/Nerdist. We bowled against, it was sort of like a YouTube, it was a YouTube episode, basically. So it was me and Freddie Wong and the guys from Barely Political versus Rooster Teeth. So that's up at youtube.com/Nerdist right now. Available 24/7. The internet doesn't close. Isn't that nice? It's there for you all the time. Unlike your dad. Oh, got a little real. Got a little real there in the end. Don't snicker, Chloe. You're supporting horrible behavior. This episode was brought to you by Audible.com. Visit Audible.com/Nerdist for your free audiobook download. You can listen to it whenever and wherever. They don't ban audiobooks anywhere unless you're in a theater and you're not wearing headphones. But you can get it anywhere. Audible has over 100,000 titles to choose from. Every genre, Audible's got you covered. If you've heard an audiobook before, chances are it came from Audible. For instance, let's say you like Neil Gaiman. You want to hear American Gods. There's like three different versions of American Gods on Audible.com. So right now, go to audible.com/Nerdist, grab a free audiobook download, and jam it in your ears after you... But jam it in on the heels of this podcast that's been jammed in your ears. There you go. Thank you so much to Audible for supporting this episode of Nerdist Podcast, which is Dave Grohl. Dave Grohl, a guy that I kind of met him like for a half a second one time, but I always really liked him because he just, you know, like you can tell he has a sense of humor. He doesn't really take himself too seriously, and so I always gravitate to those types of guys, and he did not disappoint. Dave has been doing the podcast rounds. I think he's probably also on Marin too. I'm sure that's a good listen. He is promoting this movie called Sound City that he directed. And Sound City was basically this incredibly famous recording studio. And Nirvana recorded Nevermind there, and Fleetwood Mac recorded there, and Tom Petty, and all these amazing people. There was a very special audio board there, like a mixing board that that no one else really had, and it created a very specific sound. And so just the story is this really beautifully lovely narrative of all the ups and downs that the studio had, and all the bands, and if you're a music fan, this movie will make you shit your pants in a good way. And then if you're not a music fan, I think you'll enjoy it. Just the story of it's fantastic, and Dave did a great job directing, and we had a good time. I think one of my favorite parts of this was watching. First of all, we finished. Dave's going to go into rehearsal because they're going. You know, they're doing a little tour around the album. They recorded a bunch of songs for Sound City. And then Pat Smear runs in really fast just to grab a coffee. He's like, oh, hey, guys. And then Jonah just, like, froze in his tracks. And it's kind of fun to see Jonah flustered. I don't get to see it that often, but it's really... It was entertaining for me. I don't know if Matt saw. I think he was over in the corner looking at Grohl's guitars, complaining at the runny left-handed ones. But anyway, here you go, the Nerdist Podcast number 315 with Dave Grohl. Sound City, by the way, is available February 1st. If you go to soundcitymovie.com, it'll give you all the details that you need. You can download it and see it in certain places. Official Sundance selection. Nice job. Okay, here's the podcast.
Now entering Nerdist.com. like, okay, well, now it has to be good to pay for everything.
I think warehouse is the step up from basement. Like,
yeah,
like you go basement to warehouse. Like, this is.
Well, and then it became the place where all of us would just store the shit that our wives wouldn't let us keep in the house.
Yes.
So, and now I'm about to get another storage space for all the shit that I'm not allowed to keep here.
And then, but is it stuff that you feel like you will ever touch again, or you just need to know
I'm
that you have
like
it?
I'm kind of like a pack ratty dude. Like, I don't want to get rid of my t-shirts from when I was 12.
Celebrity hoarders, come on.
Let's do it.
Right.
Leave you with that.
Where should I sit?
You can sit here.
We'll figure it out.
Let me sit and put those guys over there. This over there. This is great because in Sound City, I caught a glimpse of this painting a couple
Did you
times.
See what it was?
I couldn't exactly see what it was. I was like, well, it looks like Dave.
No, I saw it right away.
Are you rocking the fucking Ludacris headphones right now?
I am.
Word up. Call me.
I thought we were a Beats by Drake kind of podcast.
No. See, we go against the fucking.
If you caught my review on Attack of the Show,
everyone wears Beats.
Yeah,
nobody wears Soul.
I'm gonna start wearing Marley's. That's gonna be my thing.
I have.
Does
Rizzes.
He have one?
Marley Company made a whole bunch of headphones.
Really? Because you know what? Whenever I was stoned, it just sounded like I had fucking teacups over my
yes.
ears. Like
exactly.
The blood flow to my eardrums would immediately.
They're good headphones for a podcast because you can hear every insecurity and piece of apathy
and dry mouth
that comes out of
dry mouth is the worst. Remember that Cars song where he goes, "You kept it going until
yes.
the sun," and you can like hear the spit in his teeth. It's like, ooh. A little too compressed.
Go.
But you hear him go. In the movie, we interviewed Rupert Neve, who is the man, the gene,
that giant board over there,
engineering pioneer, who designed the Neve console that the movie is about, and I mean he's like 88, I think, and.
The man can rock a bolo tie. I'll tell
dude,
you that
he
way.
Looked so. Well, he lives in Texas now.
Really?
English genius lives in Texas.
That's not.
But we had to get creative with the mixing because he had a lot of.
A little mouthy. Yeah. A little bit.
That was a funny scene, too, because I was like trying to get what he was talking about, but then in your reaction shot, I was like, okay. It's like, I'm not that dumb.
When I found out that we were going to actually get an interview with Rupert Neve, I thought, okay, here's what we have to do. We have to, at some point, make it so technical that nobody will understand what they're saying and then subtitle it.
And he's fascinating, too, because his mouth is moving, but the upper part of his face looks like it passed away a while ago.
He's all brain, dude.
No. But he just, like, there was no movement above the nose, and it was just, like,
like
all
one of those
this,
old Conan bits where it's just the mouth moving?
It was almost like the mouth, or like you went into, like you stumbled across some weird satellite in space, and then this android came to life and just started telling you all the technical specs of the ship.
Like with my dad, when my father tells stories, my father was a public speaker. He was a speech writer and he wrote speeches for people in DC and was a Capitol Hill political dude and would campaign manage politicians and stuff. So he's brilliant. He's a brilliant writer. He's a really great writer. He's a brilliant dude. But he talks so fucking slowly that when he tells a story, it's like anesthesia, you know? You're just kind of like, oh, where am
can't
I?
Sleep. Can you tell me a story?
Yeah.
And was he cool with the fact that his son got into the goddamn rock music?
No, actually. That's why I did it. What are you talking about? My dad was is a classically trained flautist. So when he was young, he was sort of like a child prodigy, brilliant musician, his perfect pitch, and studied to be in an orchestra his entire life. And I think he wanted to be a professional musician, but the type of music he played, it made it really difficult. And you had to be like the best in the world to be, you know, to put food on the table from playing the flute. You know? So
there's only so many productions of Peter and the Wolf. There's only so many.
So when Nirvana broke big, was he like, you know, son,
he was like,
Jethro Tull had a lot of
I think you could use, have you heard Aqualung?
Do you know Ian Anderson personally?
But so he, you know, when I was a kid, I didn't take lessons to play music, so he's more of the school of you have to like he stopped playing the flute because he couldn't practice 6 hours a day.
Oh, wow. Gotcha.
And so I'm like the opposite of that. I'm like, give me a drum set, you know. So, but then once things really started happening, I think he was really proud that you know that I could accomplish something other than drywalling.
What you have to do is take two flutes and play drums with flutes and then just never break eye contact with him.
Oh, no.
What do you think of these drums now?
Yeah. We all got a chance to see the documentary early, and it's you texted me first, and you're like, it's fucking great. And
he actually texted me first.
Oh. I actually...
Awkward. Shit.
No, they're better friends.
Oh, good.
It's okay.
Well, you're always busy.
I'm emotionally unavailable. But
anywho.
No, we're going to work this out right now.
Good.
But I watched it last night, and it is fucking phenomenal. Like, you could have just done the documentary on Fleetwood Mac.
Oh, I know.
And yeah, but to have the
or Tom Petty
or Tom Petty or Rick Springfield
or Rick Springfield's dog.
Yeah.
Or you or McCartney. Like it really was. It was really well done, and you directed the shit out of it. Like, it was so... Yeah, it just looked good.
Okay, so I got really lucky because I have no fucking idea what I'm doing at all, right? But the people that I had come along with me for the project, it started with my one friend, Jim Rota, who I've known for 10 years or more. He's a musician. He plays in a band called Fireball Ministry, but he also is an editor, and he works in film. He's worked on films like Narnia and things like that, and he's in that world. I am so not in that world. This is like right here at our studio. This is my entire world. My house is 5 miles away. I drive my van here. We play with friends, and that's basically it. So when I heard that Sound City was closing, I mean, basically, Nirvana went there 20 years ago in 1991 to record the album Nevermind. We got a record deal, and they said, why don't you come down here to record, I think, so that they could keep their eye on us and not just send us, you know, a bunch of money and get the white album in return or whatever. So we kind of thought, so we came down here, and we're like, wow, we're going to this fancy Hollywood studio. And we got to Sound City, and it's a fucking shithole. But it had this console, which is a custom recording console built in 1973 that a lot of people consider to be the best one in the world because it had never moved, it had never been really modified, and it's just a great board. So we came down here to record the record, and we only booked 16 days, and nobody really knew what was going to happen. We thought it was a good record, but we didn't think it was going to blow up the way it did. And once it did blow up, Sound City's business kind of blew up again. They were really kind of doing well in the 70s and the early 80s, but then digital technology came around in the early, mid-80s and changed the way people make records. So when Nirvana became popular, this business was booming again, and I was always friends with those people. So about a year and a half ago, I heard they were closing, and it was sad because it was like a family-run studio, and the people that recorded there, not everybody made records there. It was kind of like this real insider type of place, and all of us were so bummed that Sound City was closing. We couldn't fucking believe it. Sound City, like this, it's like a cathedral, you know, it's like a museum. It's a really important part of rock and roll history, that place. But nobody ever really knew about it, and it almost seemed like nobody fucking cared. So I bought the board, and I thought, well, I have to tell the story of this awesome studio because it's not like some place where you walk in and there's a receptionist and you sit in the waiting room and then, you know, you go into this pristine control room and record on brand new shit. It's like, it was a fucking dump. It was like going to, you know, it was like Mount Vernon or Monticello, right, or to me at least. So I just wanted to tell the story of the board, and I thought that my friend Jim and I would just make a short film and put it online, not make a big movie. And then I reached out to all of these different musicians, and after 40 people said, yeah, I'll be in your movie, I thought, wow, this is like a movie. And what if I asked them to come back and make a new record with me? I could record with Rick Springfield. Could you fucking imagine?
I can imagine it because I saw it.
That's the thing.
When Rick Springfield starts playing the guitar, you're like, that's a fucking Springfield lick.
It's so rad. And I swear to God, like, I mean, that's the thing is that the movie's not so much about technology. It's mostly about the human element. I mean, you could make it sound like a human being recorded in Pro Tools. You just have to hit record.
Right.
It's just respecting and appreciating that human element, which is imperfect, you know? I don't think that people should strive to be perfect musicians. My favorite drummers are fucking insane. Keith Moon and Bonham and Copeland. Listen to live recordings of those people. They're this close to train wrecking the entire fucking time. But that's what's so exciting about it.
Because you're always on the edge. You're like, he's going to lose it. Oh,
yeah. And that's why you get the chills when you hear it. Like, oh, my God, did you see what he just did? Well, he'd never done that before, and he didn't know if he could really do it, but he tried, and it was awesome.
Well, it's like I feel like it's sort of like a trapeze act where – did I just say trapeze?
Yeah, you sure
it's
did.
Like a trapeze act.
Oh, oct.
Would you – But whereas it's like there's that element that you can't program to a robot, which is that drummer is probably fucked up. How is he remembering all that stuff? At any moment, he might just stand up and fall into the drum kit. But then
as
he did,
most
doesn't.
Drummers do.
But then he doesn't. Yeah. At some point.
Well, I mean, that was so then the idea sort of blossomed into being a movie, and rather than going to like a big movie studio and saying, hey, pitching an idea, I have an idea for a movie, it was like, well, fuck it, why don't Jim, me and you get a couple of your friends, and they know people who have cameras, and then we'll do it all down here, and I'll call people. And I sent out 150 fucking emails and just started doing it and paying for it, but doing it, and it was great because honestly the total amount of people involved in our crew was maybe 12 people, and we never had anyone telling us what to do. I was the fucking boss, that's terrifying.
You like doing that?
I love doing that when it's something like this, because it's like, hey Kenny, make sure you get a shot of Trent Reznor as he's doing that thing with the computer, or fucking dude, make sure that I want a shot that's Paul from Paul next to Pat and Chris. Make sure you get that, So it was awesome. I have no idea what I'm doing. It was fucking great.
But the movie really had it had a really nice arc to it. It made sense. You go through the history of Sound City and then the board, and then you sort of follow the board a little bit through a few bands, and then you get them to talk about it, and then it's present day and future. It was really nice. I did wonder how. I'm so curious. You don't have to tell me this. How much did you pay for the board?
I don't want to tell you how much I paid for it, but I got to say, it was not what I thought I was going to have to pay for it, because this thing should be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Right.
So much magic has happened on this console. It's crazy. George Harrison and Barry White and Tom Petty.
So much flow on that.
Dude, let me tell you, when we got this thing, the first thing we had to do was take a toothbrush to the insides. and there was a lot of cocaine and fried chicken.
There's a bunch of tits and drugs in the pods. I don't know how to
exactly.
Get this.
But I mean, that to
it's
me.
It's a dead groupie inside the bar. It's like the skeleton of a girl who disappeared.
Some roadie from 100 years ago. Oh!
Gollum. He's fine.
Yeah.
Hey guys.
But it was easy to do because we were sitting around with musicians and talking about music. And when you talk to musicians about the craft or about the inspiration or the passion and just jamming, it's easy to talk about. I mean, it's what we do all day long anyway.
My favorite
exchange
in that entire movie is when you say, I wish it was always this easy. And Paul McCartney just goes, it is. of course it is, Paul McCartney.
I'm an idiot.
Why are you trying?
No, I mean, it is.
One guy that can come into your studio and be like, all right, whatever you say.
Of course.
One of my favorite lines was when Butch Vigor, he was like, yeah, Butch, tell Paul McCartney what to do.
Paul McCartney says, he goes, all right, we'll just try it and tell us what you think. Like, yeah, Butch, just tell Paul McCartney what to do. Oh, we cracked up with that one. I mean, that's the thing. Is another great thing about the movie is that you see these legends in this vulnerable place. So you've got Stevie Nicks who's singing and she's tracking a song, but she's making mistakes and telling you to rewind and she's taking direction from other people. You can't really imagine someone like Paul McCartney saying, hey, what do you think?
Yeah.
He's fucking Paul McCartney. It's like, I don't want to. Yeah. You do what you do.
What do you think I think?
Yeah.
Well, not only that, but then, I'm sure the child part of your soul who you're looking and going, that's fucking Paul McCartney, is like, you just, I think maybe Pat was talking about it, or he was so stressed out about it. And then when they start playing, and you're like, oh, okay, all right, we're just playing. It's okay. And you kind of get to that muscle memory, and you go, okay, okay, it's all okay. We're not going to murder Paul McCartney.
By the way, I'd like to find the orphan he murdered so he could stay the same from 1987 on. Because he looks exactly the same. He stopped aging.
And he plays probably better than he ever has.
Amazing.
He's unbelievable. I mean, he just, like you said, if it were just a movie about Paul, for those 2 hours we had in here recording that song, the entire 2 hours on film, it would make the next generation of children want to fucking play.
But
rock.
I gotta say, God. Too, it was the most, I think, kind of getting him out of the element that he's used to being in.
Yeah.
It was the, I don't know what other term to use, so I apologize at how dumb this is going to sound. Oh, old timey phone. Hello, contact 7349.
God, Mom.
Two down, five to
hold
go.
On. Hey, Pat, I'm doing an interview right now. I didn't hear what you said because I just put it up to the microphone. Flat tire. Okay, we'll wait for you. Bye. Awesome.
I like the idea that a long time ago, someone was watching The Germs and would see Pat play and go, one day, that guy's going to play with Paul McCartney.
I remember after we did the Paul McCartney thing at at that Hurricane Sandy benefit. Mm. It was on YouTube, and we're like, wow, let's go look and see what people say.
No, don't do that.
Don't do it. We did it. And one of the best things was someone wrote, the fact that a germ is playing with a beetle is blowing my fucking mind right now.
And the fact that this is on Darby's.
But, I mean, one of the great things about someone like Paul is that, you know, his generation of musicians knows what it's like to play in a garage and sure, knows yeah. what it's like to play in with people in a backyard or in a crappy little club. And, you know, that's, I think it's really important for kids to understand that it's okay to get in your garage and sound like shit. You know, like one of the things I'm afraid will happen is that someone like my daughter, who loves the Beatles and loves singing and has a beautiful voice, we'll watch a TV show where you have to stand in line with 800 other people and then walk up to a judge and sing a song and have them say, no, you're not good enough.
Right.
Can you fucking imagine what that does to the collective psyche of the next generation?
It does exactly what it did to Marty McFly when Huey Lewis said, you're just too darn loud.
Too darn loud.
See what I mean?
Tell you that it does. I think it is a good weeding process for people who should, you know what I mean? Like, because if you really have it in you, then it doesn't fucking matter what someone says.
It definitely
says.
Gives you something to be against. But I mean, you know, but that's the thing is that when you look at Paul, the reason why Paul is fearless in playing a sig fiddle, which is a guitar made out of a cigar box, yeah. and standing next to the bass.
He's got the Hofner bass.
Right next to him.
And he's got
him.
His 1960 Les Paul, which there's only four of those that are sunburst
right
left-handed.
Right next to him.
And he doesn't touch it. And he picks up a fucking cigar
box
guitar.
I'm going to jam the cigar box thing.
Oh, that's what I was going to say. Paul McCartney sounded the rockinest that I've heard him sound. And like, even
the guy that made Helter Skelter. He can fucking rock.
But it's been a long time. Like, I feel like the last several things that he's put out have been a little...
Have you listened to the Fireman records?
No.
I have. Okay. Those are good.
You
got to
hear them.
Yeah.
Okay. Those are rocking. And they're great.
All right.
I mean, that's the thing is, like I said, I think because he's great and he aspired to be great when he was young, he wanted to learn to be a great musician. He became a great bass player. He's a great guitar player. He's a great pianist. He's a great singer. He worked at that. He's naturally gifted, obviously,
right.
But I think he really worked to be great. But he also understood that the Beatles were four people and you put them in the room together. And just being people, they sounded like the Beatles. The fucking Beatles. Like, those were just people. They weren't like, you didn't need any of this to make it sound like the Beatles. That's the way it was. And so he appreciates that. And that has to do with, like, imperfections and bad habits and the things that you do wrong. That's what makes you sound like you.
Well, that's what Frank, was it Frank Black who said that?
Yeah.
Where he said, you know.
We're talking about feel.
Yeah. Oh, my God. I think it'll be comforting to young musicians to see guys at your level like, oh, that's how they do it too, where you guys are just start playing a riff together and everyone kind of jumps in and then someone goes, oh, that.
Exactly. That part where the Trent Reznor, Josh Homme knew.
Yeah.
That was great because it was just like you were like just kind of jamming on a riff trying to figure it out. And
that's how it happens. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't need seven producers and 14 songwriters. Like, go, okay, I don't know what the biggest, most popular pop album is right now. Open up the CD booklet. Do they have those anymore?
No.
Open up your PDF.
And look at the credits.
How many people
are involved with each song? It's insane. You've got like 4 programmers. You've got 7 different songwriters. You've got 3 different producers. There's a paragraph of people that have put this song together when honestly, all you fucking need is a room with some instruments and a couple people.
Well, I think people are just, they're not, people, you know, there's a thing in our culture now where, I guess it's sort of like what you said, getting in front of the judge. We're teaching people to be afraid to fail.
Sure.
And you have to be okay with, you have to be okay with failing.
When I took my daughter ice skating a few weeks ago, she was kind of afraid to go around the rink by herself because she didn't want to fall.
Yeah.
Because she'd be embarrassed or it would hurt. I'm like, boo, you got to learn how to fall. First of all, because it's fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But also because it's just going to happen.
Yeah.
You can't become a figure skater today, you know?
Well, when you're doing, like, if you're doing a live stand-up show or if you're doing live television and someone fucks something up and then you can riff on it and it's, like, it usually ends up being the best part of the show. And people are like, I'm so sorry. And you're like, no, that was the best. Like, people are going to remember that more than the jokes that I've told 100 times.
Or like, okay, so Violet is also learning to play the violin. She's in first grade. And she's like, oh, daddy, here, come listen to Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star. And she, like, gets out her violin, and she rosins up the bow, and she puts it on her shoulder. She opens up the page to where the music is. And it sounds like someone is fucking strangling a duck on a chalkboard, you know? And she was so proud that she did it. And to her, it was good enough, you know? And it's like, that made me so happy that she's like, look, see what I can do? Isn't that cool? Fuck yeah, it's amazing. You know?
Do you? Because when you're a young performer, sometimes you get nervous, like, oh, I don't want people to think I suck, so you kind of are afraid to take risks. But then when you become successful, are you afraid to take risks? Because you're like, fuck, what if people don't think I'm great anymore if I fuck this thing up?
Yeah, both sort of. I mean, the last thing in the world you want to do is fucking ruin all the years of hard work that you've tried so hard to make great. But at the same time, it's like you can't, you know, I'll tell you how to make a bad record. Make a record that you don't want to make. Or if you want to have a shitty show, walk out on stage if you don't want to be there.
Yeah.
Like those are the things that if you do want to be there and you do want to make a great record, like those things can happen. It all has to do with you and the environment or whatever. But as long as you have enthusiasm for what you're doing, I think you can still do great things. I mean, there's no question you can always write a shitty song and they'll always make their way onto your records. But it's the energy of a performer or a musician has a lot to do with why people connect with them, I think. You know, and there's different kinds of energy. There's the energy where someone just stands there, or there's the energy where someone's diving on your head. But I mean, it just has to be for real. If you're fucking faking it, then there's just no way you're going to get what you want to get.
Yeah.
I think.
I heard you once, I have some bootleg recording from the Napster days, of you on the Stern Show when I think it's the first time he gets you to play an acoustic version of Everlong.
Oh, yeah.
And it's a fucking great segment. I mean, of course, there's a lot of like, who'd you bang? Did you bang Sheryl Crow? Like, there's a bunch of that. But then he finally gets you to, he says, do Everlong. And you're like, we've never done it this way before. Yeah. And it's a fucking, it's amazing.
That's the song I got into a car accident in.
Oh, really?
Yeah, on the 110 freeway leaving San Pedro. That's the accident I took.
Oh, that was
the
horrible accident you got in.
Yeah, like at the when it's all over, that song is still on. I was like, I should probably turn this off.
Oh no! You're welcome.
But in that interview, now Jonah cries every time. But in that interview, he's like, he asked you if your voice ever goes out, and you're like, no, I just never lose my voice. Is that true? Is that still true?
Kind of. Now that I'm old and crusty, sometimes it does, but I don't know. I think that You know, some people, like Michael Phelps.
Right.
His body is designed in a way that... Yeah, he sounds great. His body is designed in a way that he can just fucking do what he does all the time. Like, his arms are too long. And he has an extra set of
lungs. No, he's a genetic freak.
Whatever the fuck it is, you know?
Yeah, he has paddle hands.
So, I don't know what it is about my vocal cords, but they can take a lick and keep on ticking. But like, and, you know, I do everything you're not supposed to do. I don't warm up. I drink tons of whiskey. I quit smoking, though. The smoking was fucking it up. But, yeah, it can go. I I lose it every once in a while. But
the cigarettes—it's funny. Nat King Cole always said, "Well, the cigarettes give his voice." Like that's back when people thought there was a benefit to smoking.
Smoking was good for you.
Smoking was healthy. Yeah, when doctors were prescribing you. They were giving you prescription cigarettes. Like it literally, he said that it gave his voice a certain timbre.
Yeah,
but then you listen. It's so crazy to listen to. Like 60s Joni Mitchell and then like 90s Joni Mitchell where it goes from like la 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 to I'm singing a song. Like it really does fucking.
It's one of the best Joni Mitchell impressions I've ever heard.
It's pretty good. I think if I hadn't said her name, people would be like, well, that's Joni Mitchell.
Yeah, I had quit smoking once and we were making a record and I just didn't think I sounded like myself and I couldn't control my voice and I kind of convinced myself like I have to start smoking. I mean, I'm making a record, I gotta sound like
me. Your brain
right?
was looking for one reason.
Yeah.
Did it work?
Yes. Sorry kids, don't smoke.
Please don't smoke.
Bad for you.
Don't start and then you won't have to go back to it.
Yeah, there you go.
Later. What is that? Oh, that's the same was with the woman who does the voice of who Reagan's voice from The Exorcist, the demon voice is that basically he I think Blatty he convinced her to start smoking again so she could get like she had quit smoking and he got her smoking again so she could get that voice.
Or Lemmy from Motorhead.
Yeah.
I mean, can you imagine?
Does anyone have to say Lemmy from Motorhead anymore?
Well, I don't know. Sometimes no.
Tom Waits.
Know.
What if Tom Waits stopped smoking?
They're nerds. They're fucking nerds in this
Lemmy's
world.
Mole.
They're
interested. Lemmy's mole stopped smoking.
Lemmy from Motorhead. I remember once he and I are buddies. He's a great dude. He's the nicest, sweetest man in the world, and he's the real fucking deal. He is that guy. He's Lemmy, and so he texted me once, and I didn't have his number programmed into my into my new phone, and it came in like, "Hey Dave, could you put blah 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 on the list?" And I said, "Who's this?" And he said, "Lemmy." And I texted back, "Lemmy who?"
I think it would have been funny if he said, "It's funny. Lemmy from Motorhead." Like he's even also
from Motorhead. I have to tell everyone.
But yeah, I mean, could you imagine if that guy changed his voice?
No.
Please don't.
I mean, listen, look, I'm not saying kids should go smoke cigarettes and do drugs.
Right.
A lot of the Beatles stuff, there probably was some drugs involved in in some of the music that we enjoyed. I'm not saying that you should do that.
George Martin was always clean.
But isn't it great that we have it?
We have it. I got to be honest, though. I stopped doing drugs when I was about 20.
Yeah.
And I didn't really have like a fantastic drug career. I wasn't into coke and I wasn't into heroin or any of that speed or any of that shit. I like smoked weed and I, you know, took some hallucinogenics and stuff like that. But by the time I was 20, I was just like, ugh, I can't, my brain, I'm just losing it. Like, it's just too much. I don't want to be insane. And I have to be honest, I don't think that I would have accomplished fucking a quarter of the things that I've accomplished had I continued doing it.
Yeah.
No question.
Well,
like, if I was still waking up, like, if I woke up today and did 6 bong hits like I used to when I was 18, we wouldn't be doing this fucking interview. Right
now. No, this board would be in the garbage can.
That
somewhere.
Board would be in a bowl. We'd be
We'd be doing it at a scream show downtown.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing is that
in the parking lot of a fucking Carl's Jr.
The fucked up part about it is because in your brain, you're always the same age in your brain.
Yes.
You're always the same. You're always you in
timeless,
your brain.
A classic.
And so, you know, you do all this horrible shit to yourself when you're young, and then it's fun. We're in our 20s. Then you get in your 30s. It's like, okay. And then people in their 40s, you're like, fuck. And then after that, it's just lost cause.
Yeah.
Like, that guy's gone.
You know, when hangovers start to include guilt, like, that's such a drag, like a shame over, you know, where you're just like, you wake up and you feel like crap, which was expected. But then you feel like real shit because you're too old to be such a fucking
If you have
louse.
To plan your hangovers, like, well, if I do it on Friday, then by Tuesday, I should be up and running again. You should really stop.
Yeah, you got to stop.
Like at that point, it's
also
not.
Also, party wasn't this guy I know. He's like about 40 years old and he just like got too drunk all of a sudden. He's just like, oh, and he threw up. He's like, oh, fuck, I'm fucking 40.
It's a lonely feeling. Yeah. Dude, my 40th birthday, I had at Medieval Times.
Yes!
With like 200 of my friends. We had a whole section, Blue Knight one and the whole deal, our dude. And so, but at closing time, I was in the men's bathroom, drunk as fuck, smoking a joint. At Medieval Times at 40 years old, and I kind of had a little bit of an epiphany
No.
Maybe the next morning.
There could be a little pride at that moment.
I'm
going to
clear your conscience right now. If you were hammered in the bathroom Medieval Times smoking a joint and it was just a Tuesday, that's when you worry. It's okay for your birthday.
Yeah. I think my sword and shield is right over there.
Oh, did you bring it?
Yeah, see him?
Oh, nice.
Oh, you did?
I did. That's where I got my sword and shield. Yeah, Red Knight's going down, dude.
Yeah, down, down, down.
What is, I said before, like, we briefly met on Chelsea's show. Like, we were sort of passing in the hallways.
Yeah.
But I always sense from you, like, oh, Dave Grohl, like, he's a comedy guy. Like, he's a comedy nerd. Because just all the video, I don't know, there's just something about the tone of everything you do that sort of feels like you're coming from a little bit of a comedy nerd place.
Huh.
Do you not feel that? Do you not?
Well, they say all the comedians want to be rock stars and all the rock stars want to be comedians.
Yes, absolutely.
It's absolutely true. Some of the funniest people I've ever met. Have you ever hung out with Steven Tyler for 5 fucking minutes?
No.
Dude, that is some Borscht Belt fucking shit. He is the funniest,
Steven Tyler's
funniest
pun book.
Dude you've ever met in your entire fucking life. Josh Homme, have you ever hung out with Josh?
But he's a comedy nerd, too.
He's a comedy nerd, too. I mean, I don't go to clubs and see comedians. But when you meet someone really funny, and most musicians are, because, I mean, how ridiculous is that world to live in, you know? Just a bunch of fucking musicians getting drunk and playing shows all the time. It's great. It's hilarious. So I think we sort of decided early on not to take this whole thing too seriously, you know, like making videos. Where we dress up like chicks, or we dress up like chicks, like in every video.
Or right now.
The reason why I always love doing that is because I was a huge fan of Kids in the Hall.
Yes.
And so here you have a cast of 5 or 6 dudes. There's no women. So if there was a sketch where there was a woman involved, one of them would dress up like women. But play it so straight that it was immediately fucking hilariously funny, you know? Yeah. It's so Canadian, too. It's just fucking instantly funny because they're from Canada. But, I mean, yeah, I think that when it comes to everything else involved, I think it's hilarious what we do. When it comes to writing music and making albums and making songs, like, you know, that comes from another place. That's a whole other place where I'm writing things that are really important to me and that, you know, are sometimes really serious or meaningful. But when it comes to like playing a rock show, I would much rather be David Lee Roth than Tom York. You know what I mean? Because to me, it's like,
the audience agrees.
That's a fucking party to me.
Think,
you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, look, first of all, I feel like Tom York should cover everything from Crazy from the Heat. Or Jump. I would love to hear Radiohead cover Jump.
Yeah.
And then watch Tom York go.
But it would be about suicide.
I might as well. See, the direction I was going to go was try to picture Tom York doing the high kicks on stage, but I like yours so much better.
But, yeah, I mean, we all, especially in the Foo Fighters, we all come from a place where, like, we love early Van Halen just as much as we love Joy Division,
sure.
You know, and so it's, you know, music is like that it's, I don't believe in guilty pleasure. First of all, if you like fucking Britney Spears' Toxic song, then crank that shit.
Well,
you know what I mean?
And that's
a good fucking song.
Yeah, it's a good. That's why I loved the, you know, because I think especially with someone like Rick Springfield, there's certainly an ironic appreciation of Rick Springfield because he was an
ace.
Yeah, and. You make it okay because you are genuinely excited. You're like, I get to play with Rick.
Well, here's the thing is that I have issues with irony,
first of all. I don't know who
wouldn't
be excited about
like,
that.
I know. That's the thing. Is that, well, that's okay. Don't get me started.
Go ahead.
So, here's the thing is that I think that that irony and guilt are really dangerous to music because what it does is it creates like boundaries or restrictions, and it makes it so that you're questioning the whether something's like real or legitimate all the time, rather than just being for fucking real. Why not be for fucking real?
Yeah,
you know. So, my generation of musicians obviously just dove headfirst into irony and guilt, and like, well, you can't do that because that's not fucking. I'm punk rock, and you're not, and that's not fucking cool. And Aerosmith, yeah, that Gene's got a gun, that's cool, yeah.
You know? That's the worst side effect of punk.
I swear to God, and you're right,
yeah.
Because you know, I grew up in the Washington D.C. area, And so the bands that I first started playing in were hardcore punk rock bands in the early 80s. And so I got to see all of these legendary hardcore American punk rock bands in D.C.
Spent a lot of time in the 930 Club.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so that was like, that whole scene was all about like integrity and being for real. Especially Washington, D.C., kind of more than a lot of other cities. Like Discord Records, which is a D.C. based independent record label
run by Ian MacKay
from Fugazi and the Evens. He was a huge inspiration, hero of mine when I was a kid, because he just fucking did everything for real. You know what, the show's $5 and it's only gonna be $5. Your fucking album is $3.50 postpaid. If you have to pay any more than that, you're getting fucking ripped off.
Yep.
And he fucking walked it like he talked it, just like Neil Young or just like fucking Lemmy or all of these really inspirational dudes to me, because you meet them and you're like, oh yeah, they're totally for fucking real. So when I would go see bands where I wasn't sure if it was real or not, I would get kind of confused. Like, you know, and I think it's a horrible side effect of the punk rock thing that people all of a sudden thought, well, I'm not supposed to like this. What the fuck is that supposed to mean?
Yep.
Like, I mean, you're not supposed to like, I remember playing Primus at a fucking like punk rock party in Olympia and I almost got lynched. It was like, because it's not fucking cool. And it was like, well,
Calvin
Johnson,
you gotta go.
Kind of. People would make fun of you for the music that you listen to, and that's what all those fucking punk rockers hated.
Yeah.
They all got made fun of because when I was a kid listening to fucking whatever, Dead Kennedys or Black Flag or any of that shit, I grew up in suburban Virginia. I would have gotten my ass kicked every fucking day for that music. And then all of a sudden, like, you've got the same thing coming from the other side. Well, you're not allowed to listen to this either. It's the same fucking deal. It drove me crazy. So I feel terrible for anyone that's affected by that kind of irony or guilt. Because
see,
it
guys?
Should not be that way. It really shouldn't. Because, I mean, that's the thing. It's like, and especially, like, this whole new generation of kids that, like, they just don't know what's a... My daughter, who's six, she likes everything.
Yeah,
because she doesn't know.
That's what six-year-olds do.
Exactly,
because they're not fucking jaded yet.
Exactly. Yeah. What's wrong with that? It's fucking great. She'll sit there and listen to the entire Beatles vinyl box set by herself, and then she'll go fucking listen to an iCarly record.
Because they're fearless. Yeah. The six-year-olds are fearless. When
because
you get older,
they just
you learn.
Enjoy
you
it.
Plus, they enjoy melody.
They fucking enjoy. Yeah, like real good shit.
Yeah, but you shouldn't feel guilty for something you like.
No,
exactly.
I did a press event over the weekend, and so someone drove me to the event.
Thanks, Mom.
Mom.
But I was in the back of the car, and this is before I saw the documentary, but I have Rick Springfield on my iPhone, and Affair of the Heart came on, which I fucking love.
Dude, you got
and
to.
I cranked it, and it was like vibrating in my headphones, and there was a minute where I got a little self-conscious because I looked up, and the driver, like our eyes just met for a second, like he could hear it bleeding through, and I felt...
He liked it too, dude.
Yeah.
He liked it too. He didn't want to admit it, but
if
he liked it
too. If you
had taken your headphones out, you'd realize he was playing it in the car.
Oh, that's good.
Exactly.
It was Rick Springfield. But then we had this moment where I saw the crossroads. I was like, I either turn this down or I commit to it, and I committed to it, and I feel like it was the right choice.
You know,
you like it.
That's and also Rick Springfield's a great example. Now, what he does is not that different than what a lot of bands do today. What he did then, if you listen to like Love Is All Right, mm-hmm. or what's another good one? I've Done Everything For You.
Yep.
I've Done Everything For You, first of all, could have been a Buzzcocks song. I know this because we're learning all of his songs because we're doing gigs where we're going out with all of the people from the Sound City Movie and doing shows. Like, we're doing an LA show, we're doing a New York show, we're doing a London show, we're doing a Berlin show, we're doing a Sydney show, we want to do South by Southwest with all of these musicians. And so you should go out there and look at the chart of songs we have to fucking learn. It's insane. I have to learn 50 songs in the next 10 days. But as we're learning these Rick Springfield songs, because it's going to be Rick singing with the Foo Fighters as the backing band, we're doing a bunch of his shit. We're doing 5 or 6 of his songs. And honestly, you know what it sounds like? The fucking Foo Fighters with Rick Springfield.
That's exactly what I was saying when you were playing that song in the documentary. I just said, that sounds like Rick Springfield with the Foo Fighters.
It's true. Like, so, but when you look at what he does, you know, that sort of guitar-based rock, pop sensibility structure, it's kind of, you know, it shouldn't be, it shouldn't really be, it shouldn't be placed in just the 80s, because it's not. It's almost 70s. It's almost 60s. And it's, and still to this day, like, there's so many bands that do the same thing. The world could use another fucking Rick Springfield right now.
I hope that it, I hope it gives them a nice resurgence. I'm probably just reading into this or projecting fears that I have, but when I see him in interviews, it just feels like behind his eyes he's going, fuck, I just want it back. Like, you know, like he just fucking wants it.
He's
just
got it.
But why wouldn't he? Why wouldn't he want it all back?
I mean, I remember ages ago someone saying, like, how long do you think you'll be doing this? When the Foo Fighters first started, it was 1995, and I was 26, I think. I'm 44 now. And I remember then saying, you know, I think I'll probably do it until I'm about 33. Because I don't want to be one of those old guys on stage, you know? I don't want to be, like, running around.
But you're the same age in your brain.
It's true. Yeah.
And you get to 33 and you're 11. Like, well, 33. I didn't realize it was this. This is nothing.
I'm still 15.
Yeah, what's the problem?
But, you know, I think that someone like Rick or someone like Mick Jagger or someone like Paul or any of those people, you see that you can – the reason why they do it now, I think, is the same reason why they did it then, which is just for the love of doing it. And – you know, a lot of people play music with no career aspiration, and that's entirely the best way to do it, I think. You know, when, of course, you're a kid and you have a Kiss poster or you have a fucking, I don't know, do kids have posters anymore?
I don't think
they just have digitally projected gifts.
You know, you have your heroes.
Gifts.
You have these people like, wow, Deadmau5, or you have Paul Stanley or whatever
Skrillex.
It is. Skrillex.
General Public, what do the kids listen to? I stopped listening to music in the 80s.
So you have those heroes, but in a way it almost doesn't seem real. Like, it almost seems impossible. At least it did to me when I was young. Like, I never thought I could be a famous musician because they almost seemed untouchable.
Sure.
Or, like, unreal. So, and especially playing, like, hardcore punk rock, there wasn't a lot of career opportunity in that. It was just like, fuck, I gotta play, you know? I had friends, and we were writing these songs, and I would write songs about, like, my dog and my teacher and crap like that. And it was great. It was fun. But never in your wildest dreams did you imagine that you would be, like, famous or whatever.
Sure.
And coming from that place, I think there's a real love of just playing and just writing and just playing with friends. And so when you look at someone like Paul, he's a perfect example. When he came in that day, it was like, fuck it, let's just play whatever and let's just go for it. You know, it's not like he wants to be any more famous than he already
is. Oh my god, when he
fucking jam.
Oh, by the way, here's the bass I used on Love Me Do.
Yeah.
And when you're on the couch and he jumps into your arms, there's that moment where, like, but don't drop him, it's Paul McCartney. I'm like, you're gonna break him. Like, you just feel like you're gonna.
No, he's fucking. But so, you know, I think that it's important for people to understand that too. Like, you know what? If you're recording shit at home, write an awesome song and then fucking delete it. How about that? I used to do that because I wanted to feel like proud of myself. Write a great song and just erase it immediately. Yeah,
get rid of it.
Tell it.
I don't even care.
Stupid song.
Undo. Control Z.
Apple Z.
Do you feel like you have a lot of those moments left in your life where you? Because I feel like, you know, when Paul McCartney comes in and you as Dave Grohl are like, holy shit, you're like, how do you keep generating those moments of wonder and excitement? And
well, there's you can get that outside of music too, you know, but I mean, musically,
no, I think it's just work.
I think that I wrote an email the other day to Rob, the bass player of Black Rebel Motorcycle Club, mm-hmm. who's also in the movie, and one of my favorite bands. They're fucking awesome. Yeah. And he's such a good dude, and they're such a good band. And the perfect kind of band, I think, for me at least, that they can come in and we can start from scratch and wind up with a fucking killer song in 4 hours, you know? Like, then those are the best ones when they just happen. That's how Nirvana was. Like, we would start out just with a noise jam and it would sort of kind of turn into an arrangement, and then you have, like, Come As You Are. And that was how it would happen in the rehearsal space.
And then that was part of when you came into Sound City. How prepared were you guys?
We were so prepared, dude. It was, I mean, we honestly, we rehearsed in a barn and we rehearsed 6 days a week for 4 hours a day because we had nothing else to do.
Well, did you know the barn would be cleaner than Sound City?
Yeah, exactly. Let's go back to the barn. But what I was going to say was that I was talking to Rob about this, and he said like how honored he was and how excited he was and flattered that they're in the movie and that their song is on the soundtrack. And I told him, I said, you know, I'm actually the one that should be really honored, because it doesn't matter at what level of fame you're at. When you meet another musician, I mean, when you meet another musician, it doesn't matter what level of fame they're at. It's about how much your music has like affected you and how much it's touched you that makes you feel nervous or makes you get excited or gives you that roller coaster feeling when you meet Paul McCartney.
Right.
It's because his music has been such a huge part of my life that I get freaked out around him. Not as much anymore. I mean, it never wears off, but he's a good dude. He doesn't make you feel uncomfortable or nervous. You make yourself feel that way. He's just a good dude, you know. But, you know, if I were to meet someone like, I don't know who's a good example, some, you know, like an enormously famous South American pop star who I'd never heard before in my life, I'd just be like, hey, what's up, man? How are you? Because what do I fucking care? You know, like they're just a person. But then if you meet someone that has that thing that you've connected to your entire life, it's like, oh my God, it's like meeting a ghost or meeting God or whatever the
fuck.
What's
your worst?
Like, wow.
Ghost God.
Do you have
plenty of bad musician experiences. There's so many assholes, like, dude. You have no idea.
Not just that, but situations where you just clammed up and you just were like, oh, I, and you came away.
For sure. Absolutely. What were some good ones? Bonnie Raitt. The first time I met Bonnie Raitt, I was just like, oh, blah, blah, blah. You know, there's plenty. Yeah. I mean, I'm just as much a fucking dork as I was when I was 15. And I feel that way when you meet someone really, you know, special.
And that should never go away.
I don't think it ever really does. If it does, then you're in deep shit, dude.
Yeah,
I feel like I hope that it never goes away. There's some comics now, like some of the older comics. They just, a few of them just sort of look a little dead behind the eyes. I'm like, oh, I just don't want that. I still want to love comedy, and I still want to love meeting people and nerding out over things. Like, I don't want that to go away ever.
Tell me if I'm wrong. I have this theory that sometimes when comedians just sort of die inside.
Yeah.
And they're not funny anymore.
Yeah.
Is it that most comedians come from sort of a dark place and then they eventually bring like antidepressants into their life and they lose all the funny?
I see what I don't even think that's just comedians, and maybe it's on antidepressants, but I think the bigger issue, I think about this shit all the time, is when you're young, for any artistic endeavor, I think there's just a hunger. There's like I fucking have to do it. Yeah. I just want to do it. You know, like no matter what anyone says, there's of course, I think, a level of I want to be noticed. I want attention. I want to do well. I want to be recognized for my work. I want to bring this into the world. I want to, you know, I want to make people laugh. I want to make people jump around, whatever. And then I think people do that a lot. And then they get a lot of money. They get comfortable. They're not challenged as much anymore. The work isn't as challenging anymore. They don't want to take as many risks. They kind of get happy. And it's just like, I think the hunger just sort of dissipates. You're like, well, you know, maybe there's a chemical thing that happens as you get older. You just don't, you know, like, well, we don't need to spread our DNA anymore at this age. So we just don't really care about being noticed. Or, you know, I don't know what it is.
Maybe they just never had fun with it in the first place. And once they get to a place where they're just doing it out of anger and just like because they needed to, and then they succeed in that, and then they're just doing it, and they're getting the money, and it's not fun for them.
But sometimes,
maybe that's why
sometimes
kinda...
when people get older, they just run out of stuff to say. And I think that's like the essential element. Like when you see a musician playing, you know, 40 years after they were popular, 30 years after they were popular, you go, yeah, technically it's really good, but the stuff they're writing now, they're just not saying anything that really, they just don't have anything to say anymore, really, that they care that much about.
Yeah, it's true.
So maybe it's the same for both, I'm guessing.
Well, I think that you have to like sort of let your career or your music follow your life, you know, not to try to stay in that place where you were 20 years ago, but
yeah.
sort of make sure that in a real honest way that it mirrors your life now and that it follows you. Like if I look back at all of our records, the Foo Fighters records, it's like watching a kid grow up. You know, the first record is like a babbling fucking baby that shits the bed every day.
I enjoyed that baby.
Thank you. And, you know, and then it's, and then there's the album that sounds like Puberty. And then there's the album that sounds like Independence. And then the one that sounds like a conflicted adult.
Maybe
then,
there's a point where sometimes you just get to, where people just get too sophisticated. You know, like when you become so good, and when you're young, you're just playing and you just want stuff to sound cool. But then you get older, you're like, oh, I could tweak this a little bit, and this needs to be this, and this needs to be like, yeah. maybe it's just overly engineered as you get older. I don't know.
You know, if you listen to the new Neil Young record, which is insane because some of the songs are 24 minutes long or whatever, but when you listen to it, it's awesome. When you listen to it, it's so simple. It's the opposite of that. It's going back to a place where he's kind of like trying to simplify or go rather than like his refined songs, you know, which were still pretty rough around the edges because that's the way he always was. But he's going back to before that to like these long jams that you appreciate for their simple quality. And it's awesome. And I think that, like, when bands get back together to make records after they've been away for a really long time, there's the danger of trying to recapture what they've done before.
Mm-hmm.
Or there's the danger of them doing something that might not be recognizable as that band. And it's tricky, you know, you have to navigate through all that shit. But ultimately, what you do is you just make music that you really feel for. Something that feels real, you know. If we were to come out and one of the reasons why the Foo Fighters is still around is because we didn't really follow any of those little trends that have happened in the last 20 years. You know, we didn't go new metal when it was huge, and we didn't like do the New York skinny tie thing when it was huge. And at those times, we weren't huge because that shit was. But we lived comfortably in our little world, just doing what we did, I think that that's why we've survived. Had we done any of that shit, it would have seemed contrived and it wouldn't really have been like us. And I think it's the same way. As you grow, as you get older, you just keep doing what you feel natural doing.
I worked at K-Rock from 95 to 97, I think, or 98. And I remember the first time I ever heard of the Foo Fighters, there was a poster for a show and it said like Mike Watt and Foo Fighters. And I think it was like 95 or 96. Yeah. And I'm like, what the fuck are the Foo Fighters? Someone's like, no, it's the drummer from Nirvana. I'm like Phil Collins? Like I couldn't, you know, there was that moment. I'm like, wait, he's coming out from behind the, you know, like what did that feel? Like, is that something that you always want to do or just went, well, fuck, I guess, why not try this?
Well, I started playing guitar first when I was maybe like 11 years old. And I took maybe two or three lessons from this guy at the strip mall down the street. And then, but I wasn't learning what I wanted to learn. I wanted to learn how to play Beatles songs because I loved the Beatles. And so I had their two greatest hits records, the red one and the blue one. And my mom bought me this book that was a complete Beatles anthology, but the chord charts. So I would listen to the songs and I'd play along with the chords. And, I play along with the records, and that's kind of how I learned how to play. And eventually I started listening to punk rock and the Rush and, you know, metal and crap like that. And I joined a punk rock band and where I played guitar, and the drummer sucked shit. He was fucking terrible. And I just sort of had this natural inclination to do it. I understood how to play the drums. I knew how to play the drums. Like, I just knew that this sound is the hi-hat, that sound is the kick, and that sound is the snare. And I'd listen to a song, and I could make my arms do what I heard on the radio. So I finally just said, like, Dave, his name is Dave. Dave, give me the fucking... And he started playing bass, and I started playing drums. And then I started practicing, but I didn't have a drum set. So I put pillows...
Dave, can I use your drum set?
Yeah, I did, exactly. And so... So I would sit down on the floor and put a pillow right there, and this would be my Tom, and that would be my Tom, and there's a chair
That's
there.
That's exactly
that
what
would,
I did.
Did you?
Yeah, the pillows and cardboard boxes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that was my hi-hat, and I would put on a record and play along to it, and that's how I learned how to play. And so I never took any lessons. It was just that. And so because I understood how to play guitar and I understood how to play the drums, I would record things by myself. Like when I was fucking 12 or something, I figured out how to multi-track with two cassette decks.
Oh, nice.
So I would play guitar recording on this one cassette, and then I would take that cassette and put it in the home stereo, put another cassette in this recorder, hit record on that, hit play on that, and I would sing along to the guitar as it was coming through. Then I'd take that tape, which now had vocals and guitar, put that in the thing, and then I'd play drums along to it, and I'd have a song. And I would write songs about my dog and about my fucking teachers or whatever. And so then once I got a little older and I had friends who had like a 4-track studio or an 8-track studio, I would, they'd ask me, hey, will you come play drums on my stuff? And I'd do it for weed. But I would also do it for tape, where I'd say, yeah, I'll do it if you can give me like 3 minutes of tape. And I would record an instrumental just by myself. So I'd put the drums down first, and then I'd put the bass and guitar over it, and I'd take it home, and I'd play it for my best friend and say, listen to this new band. And he'd be like, wow, that's cool. Who's that? And I'd say, that's me, dude.
That's me.
That's, I'm playing everything. That's, he's like, how'd you do that? I'm like, well, you do the drums.
Yeah, comedians can't do that as well. Listen to this amazing new comedy. Yeah. That sounds like you.
And ah, just you got me.
Stare into the eyes.
Damn it.
So, but that was what the... So for years, I did that by myself just for fun, just to... as I was in Nirvana... I had a studio in my basement, and I recorded all of those songs by myself, the Foo Fighters songs, and would play them for maybe like my sister or my friend Jimmy, but not everyone. Maybe Kurt, I played him a couple songs. But then after Nirvana was over, fucking what else was I going to do?
Yeah.
I was like, you know what? I'm going to go down the street to this studio, a 24-track, and book 6 days, whoa, which to me was like an eternity in the studio. So I booked the 6 days and I recorded that stuff by myself, and I made copies for all of my friends. And this record company dude got it and was like, hey, I want to put it out. I'm like, okay. It wasn't a band or anything. It was just, I called it Foo Fighters so people would think it was a group of people because it was plural. So I thought like, yeah, if you were not to tell anyone that this was the dude from Nirvana, would people still like the music?
Yeah. Which is really interesting, because I think a lot of, there is the other side of the mentality where someone's like, I have to use my Nirvana cred to try to get, and then you're trying to do the opposite of going, no, I want people to think it's different so they don't come in with
preconceived
notions.
Right, I mean, the
notions.
Last thing you want to do is have the foundation of everything you're working hard for be something else. You know?
Right.
So to me, it was like, plus, I mean, with Nirvana, it was such a tragic ending, and Kurt died, and it was like, at that time, I didn't really want to think about Nirvana. It was heartbreaking. We were fucked up by what happened.
Yeah.
So it's like, I just got to keep playing music. I got to keep playing music. And so then I thought like, well, maybe, you know, maybe I'll start a fucking band. That'd be weird. And there's a band, Sunny Day Real Estate from Seattle.
Great band.
Who, they're a great band that were about to break up. And my friend Tracy told me, you got to go see them play. It's like their last show, but nobody knows that. And I saw...
It's like getting a stock tip.
Yeah, totally. So I saw Nate, our bass player now, and William, our original drummer, play, and they're fucking great. And after the show, I said, hey, here's a cassette of this stuff I recorded, and let's jam. And we did, and it was so fun. And I didn't know how to stand with a guitar or sing. It was so awkward. It was fucking so weird that it was perfect. Because the last thing I wanted to do was... be a drummer at that time. You know, I didn't want to play an instrument that would remind me of my friend who died, or I didn't want to fucking, you know, just be a drummer for the rest of my life, because I knew like, well, I can also try to do other things.
Wow, that's really interesting. I never even, that's a sort of a part of the emotional evolution of what you did that never occurred to me before, like that you're still within music but doing completely different things to not be reminded of what happened.
Sure.
Because you're still kind of dealing with that.
Yeah.
Tragedy.
Well, I mean, it was, you know, Kurt died in April of 94, and the first time I jammed with Will and Nate was like December of that year. And all of those months in between, it was just like, oh my God, what the fuck? Like, is my life over too? This is crazy. And, but, you know, music is so powerful that it honestly it can help you heal. That was the hard part, was that music was what was breaking my heart, but at the same time it's what could make me feel better. And so to me it was all about not living in what had happened, but looking forward to what's next.
Was that hard when Foo Fighters started breaking out, but then people just wanted to talk about Nirvana?
Absolutely.
And you're like, please,
well, it wasn't hard, but it was.
I mean,
it
emotionally
was totally
hard,
expected.
Though.
Kind of, yeah. The first year, because you'd get like this rogue journalist that would ask you, like, "Hey, what did it feel like when you found out Kurt died?" It's like, I should punch you in the fucking teeth right now. You know, that's so rude. You would never ask just anybody that. Wow, your mom just died? Wow, how'd that make you feel?
Like, that's weird. Is that kind of a bummer? That's probably a bummer.
Yeah. Like, you know, you just want to fucking throttle them, you know?
Yeah.
But so there were times. And
the unanswerable questions.
Well, but there were great ones, too. Like, well, why'd you start a band that sounds like Nirvana? I'm like, I don't know, because that's how I play music. I was in a fucking band. That's how I play music. What do you want me to start
they're
a reggae band? What the fuck?
They're accusing you of copying
of being
yourself.
Me. Yeah. It was, so I was kind of like, okay. But then after a while, I think that's where this whole little bubble began. Like, you know what? Let's just do our own fucking thing. Yeah. And fuck everybody else. Let's
that's
just
usually where the best stuff comes
it.
From, where yeah. it's just where you just kind of do it for you. But I remember seeing interviews or, you know, reading stuff. Like, first of all, that era of Nirvana, like that Nirvana era of music was kind of I feel like the last great era of like of the music business before it started to slide a little bit with all the digital stuff, kind of to parallel what, you know, what the where the documentary goes with digital everything and people doing stuff at home and Pro Tools and whatnot. But
well, you know, see, the thing is, I mean, it's easy to feel that way, and I feel that way sometimes too, of course, but there's hope, you know, because I think we're at a place right now where we were just before then. Remember Star Search?
Of course.
Remember all the shitty fucking balladeers that were making that faceless bullshit?
2¾ stars.
Pop? Sam Harris.
Right. So we're in the same place, man. Music was so like overproduced and so glamorized.
I just meant the music business. But I agree with
well,
what
the
you're
business
saying.
Too. Well, this is another parallel, is that, you know, when we were in those punk rock bands and we were playing the music that wasn't commercial or whatever back then, we were sort of restricted to these independent channels, right? So we made music the way we like to make music, because who the fuck was, we couldn't get the world to hear it, because there was no big label that was going to sign us and put it around the world. So we were left to our own devices and making real cool fucking music. Well, nowadays it's kind of almost the same. Who wants to sign to a fucking major label? Yeah. Who needs it? You don't. You have all of those obstacles that we had back then. You can race past those now.
One YouTube video.
I swear to fucking God. Look at Justin Bieber.
Right.
You know, I mean, it's like one ring to rule them all. But you know,
I hope
like,
me and Selena work it out. Are you guys? Are we all on board?
I fingers
here?
Crossed.
It's like,
you know what? One love. I
seriously.
Ring. So, but you know, that's the thing, is that it can still happen. It's almost like I look at what's accepted as mainstream popular music now, and I'm not satisfied. I mean, who the fuck am I to say anyway? But if I were a 12-year-old kid, who the fuck, what am I going to relate to that guy that just won the fucking Star Search competition? Am I going to relate to the fucking dude that wears too much makeup on TV?
But
or
I think they
relate
do.
Relate to the fucking, well, you'd hope so, because you want kids to have faith in music. But ultimately what happens is you get this dissatisfaction, because it's like, oh, like my dad beats the fuck out of me and people make fun of me at school and fuck all that shit, man. I want someone like me making music for fucking me.
Yeah.
And that's eventually what happens when you when everyone is left to their own devices, I think, you know. And so, and as long as you let them know that that opportunity is real, that you can do it, even if no one fucking hears it, go do it anyway. But like, it can still happen. There's still hope. There will be fucking angry teenagers until the end of time.
Yeah, you can't. They're just programmed to be angry, and you can't relate to them. And even when you're a teenager, and you're like, "Well, I'm older. I'm totally gonna know how to talk to teenagers." And then you talk to them, and their eyes glaze over, and you're like, "You are biologically programmed to hate everything I'm saying right now."
Right.
And there's no way in.
But I mean, also, like, you know, when I get really passionate about this kind of shit, it's because, you know, I remember how great it was to feel that way back then. Well, I'm an old guy now, you know? I'm the guy that they should be fucking pissed off at.
Not yet. You're not old yet.
I'm just saying. So, I mean, but,
we're not that far apart, Nate. Yeah. You're not old yet, Dave.
Keep telling yourself that. Man.
Shut up, David. Yeah.
But I mean, no, but you know, I think there's hope. I don't think that's the last generation of great rock and roll music.
Right.
No. It's fucking, there's
but
more.
But there is no
kids
more.
Will always find it. They'll always find a scene. They'll always find a way to do it. It's just, you know, it's just not always
like
laid
fucking
out.
Rats,
there was
dude.
But from that period, I feel like there were a couple of the guys, you know, between Kurt and like Eddie Vedder and a few of the guys who, like, after they became popular, it was sort of like, I don't like this anymore. What was that?
That was the Punk Rock Guild.
Oh.
No question.
Punk Rock Guild. Okay,
Punk Rock Guild.
Yeah.
You ask someone like Lemmy, his generation is entirely different. Like, what the fuck does Lemmy care about punk rock shit? He's the real deal. He just walks it like he talks it. If you told Lemmy, like, hey, man, your album just sold 30 million copies, you think he'd be fucking bummed out? No. He would be the happiest man on earth.
Yeah.
There was something, I think there was some residual weirdness and guilt that came from that.
You have to, like, give up your indie cred.
Musician.
Well, I wonder, there's a difference. Like, some people who come from, like, you know, a working class background and then an art class background. I think those
perhaps.
Are two. Like, the working class background is like, of course you want to fucking make money. What are we doing?
Right.
And the arty class people are like, this is wrong, you guys.
You know,
like,
even
why?
In, even
well,
on that,
you know,
on that last Tenacious D record, like, you know, Jack has that line where, like, he's just like in the Ballad of Jack in the Rage Cage or whatever. It's like he talks about how, like, he gave up his indie credibility. You know, like, kind of tore him apart.
I mean, you know, there's great things about, I think, both sides of that argument. And it's also, it's not like a two-sided coin. It's like a fucking one of those
Dungeons weird
and Dragons
coin.
Dice that has 12 sides to it. But, it, you know, I just think that you should feel free to be free as a musician, you know? When Nirvana signed to a major label, I don't think there was a lot of worry that we were, like, signing up with this big, heavy corporation, you know, because we came from this punk rock scene. We were making good music, and we wanted everyone to hear it. We wanted people to be able to get it rather than just be confined to this one thing. We were like, fuck it. You know, we didn't change what we do. We changed the way it was, like, delivered to the people, but it never changed the music.
Yeah.
And that was the most important thing to us, you know. But, you know, there's an argument there about integrity and that whole guilt with the punk rock thing. Yeah. But honestly, one of the proudest, most happiest moments in my life was going back to Washington, D.C., I don't know, a couple years ago. The 930 Club had their 30th anniversary. It was a big deal. Like, Rollins, who was from D.C., was emceeing. Ian MacKay and his band The Evens played. All of our old friends from D.C. were there. And you can imagine, like, that I would feel sort of nervous or conflicted about, like, hanging out with all of these people who were heroes of mine because of that integrity and that sort of punk rock ethic, you know, that do-it-yourself thing. They would never do a lot of the things that I've done. And I came back home, and they were, like, proud of me.
Oh.
I was like, how fucking cool that the people you would imagine to be the most... elitist or judging of that sort of thing are the ones that are doing it for real, and they're like, hey man, good on you.
And you, because you wrote that
job.
Whole story in your head about them.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so, I mean, that to me was like, oh God, I felt so validated. I'm like, oh, phew. I mean, they might still think I'm a douche, but at least they're proud of me.
As long as you can still take the credit for it. You can still take the good points for it.
That's the thing. I mean, honestly, like, it's too easy to be cynical. That's the easy way out. It's just too easy in all, like, areas of
your
life.
This is an impossible question to answer, and I apologize if it's out of bounds, but do you think Kurt would have gotten over that stuff?
Impossible to answer.
Yeah.
Who knows, you know? I mean, again, like, I think as you get older...
You get more... You're like, it's not that big.
It's so fucking great to be pissed when you're young.
Yeah.
It's the fucking best, man. You just want to fuck shit up. Fuck you. I remember taking acid and, like... yelling at old people, like, fuck you!
What did I do?
Whatever, yeah. And I mean, you know, as you get older, I think you just sort of start to realize, Michael Bolton's not that bad, you know, or whatever.
What did you ever do to me?
You sort of loosen the reins a little bit.
Well, especially now, like, you know, you have kids and you have that board. Like, everything's nice. It's kind of nice.
You think I'm going to fucking teach my kid that it's not cool to listen to fucking whatever. Actually, that was a huge moment of being a parent. Was there was one day, first of all, my mother, who was a brilliant woman, is a brilliant woman, never told me to not listen to any kind of music. I listened to fucking Satan worshiping, kill the fucking president music for years. And my brilliant English teacher mother never told me, you're not allowed to listen to Corpse Grinder or whatever. You know? And so she never put any of those restrictions on me. Thank God. There was one day when my daughter Violet was maybe like a year and a half or maybe two. And the Amy Winehouse record was really big. It's a great record. It's such a brilliant record. It's a fucking amazing record. And the song Rehab was a huge hit. Well, my two-year-old would sing the Rehab song, which there's nothing funnier than a two-year-old that just knows the word Rehab, you know, because she's going to know it eventually. And so so she would sing, she called it the No-No song. No, no, no. She's like, I want to hear No-No. I want to hear No-No. So then one day, and she was also fully like, she had mastered an iPhone by like 7 months or whatever. So I come home from being on the road, and she's in the back seat, and she's got my wife's iPhone, and all of a sudden I hear this like this gangster rap shit with like gunshots in it and stuff like that, and I look at my wife like, the fuck is she listening to right now? She goes, ow, I made a mistake, and I downloaded this song. I was wanted to download the video for Rehab, but I downloaded this rapper named Rehab. I'm like, what is that? Fortunately, there were like, it was the song, I don't even remember what it was called. It was, sorry, Rehab. It was just bad music. It was like not even good rap.
Rehab.
And the
He's
dude
fine.
Singing the chorus
this.
Didn't really have a great voice.
Rehab, all respect, just wasn't very good.
It just wasn't a great song. Who am I to say? But it was a piece of shit. So I turn around. Sorry, Rehab. I turn around to my daughter, who's two, and I go, hey, boo, what are you listening to? She goes, it's my new song. And I go, oh, yeah? She goes, yeah. And I go, that's not really a good song. She goes, well, I like it. And I said, well, I don't. And she goes, well, I do. And she listened to it like 8 times in a row. And I realized at that moment, like, I'm a parent.
Yeah. You just made the next creation.
I just had that moment with my child, and I will never have it again. So, you know, I try to get her to listen to. She got the Beatles box set. She loves the fucking Beatles stuff. I got her a Wings record the other day. I got her an Elvis record. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to get her into, like, you know, music.
Cut to 20 years from now when you're giving your daughter away to Rehab, who's like, I got your back, Dave Grohl.
I had this conversation with someone the other day who was like, man, you know what I fucking hate? I fucking hate it when you go to a show and you see a kid who likes the same fucking music as their dad, man. That's not fucking cool. You're not supposed to like the fucking music your dad fucking likes. It's important for them to not like the music that their parents like. I'm like, okay, so wait, are you saying that it's better for your kid to listen to, I don't want to fucking diss anybody.
Let's say it's Rehab again, because you've already opened the floodgates.
Right. So, yeah.
Well, I think we've spent just about an hour with you, and you probably...
I talk too much.
No, you don't. Oh. I would talk to you for 3 more hours, but I always feel guilty when people come on, because I don't... Just from having done 1.5 million interviews, sometimes I worry, like, I don't want people to start getting stressed, like, I got to go, but he won't let me go,
right.
You know? So I don't want to keep you if you have to...
The only thing is I have to learn
50
songs today. It's awesome what we've been doing and what we're doing.
What are you going to... Just real quick, what are you going to learn today?
Well, we've learned most of the Rick Springfield stuff. Love is All Right. Jesse's Girl.
Mm-hmm.
I've Done Everything for You. Love Somebody. And
I fucking love that song.
It's so good. And the song from the Sound City soundtrack movie with Rick, which is called The Man That Never Was.
Right.
So it's pretty radical set list. And I mean, honestly, we could learn 10 more. It's pretty rad. But we're trying to learn a bunch of songs for each person.
Yeah.
And it's amazing. Like, you know, we're learning like Stevie Nicks songs.
That's great.
And so for us to play something like
Fleetwood Mac is
Dreams,
one of,
or
it's just
Gold
one of my
Dust
all-time
Woman
favorite
like,
bands. The collection of those people and that period of time when album art really meant like just those the covers of them where he's like
iconic.
In the fucking fencing pants.
Oh, yeah.
Like the oh my god,
and the tights,
the tights, just all of it. And he, I get stressed out hearing
Lindsey Buckingham talk about those days, because in the what I'm thinking, he can, I don't know how he cannot go. And then that's right before Mick Fleetwood fucked my girlfriend. Like, it's so hard not to, like, when he talks about, I don't know, I get, there's like a whole 90210 thing.
Can you imagine?
That fucking
George and
with that band,
you know, which made for some pretty incredible records.
Yeah.
Like, if you listen to the record, the first record with Lindsey and Stevie that was recorded on this board, if you listen to that record, there are so many different personalities on that. Christy McVie and John McVie and Mick Fleetwood and Lindsey and Stevie, like, you know, they each kind of have their place on that record, which is crazy. It's not often that you get a band that's made of so many brilliant people.
And
you know?
Named after the two people who do not sing in the band.
Yeah, you're right. I didn't think about that. There you go. Yeah.
But, well, thanks, man. So, when does Sound City come out?
Sound City, the movie is coming out February 1st.
Okay.
That's when it's available to get.
It is genuinely a fucking awesome movie, and I really hope people watch
it. It's weird, man. Yeah. I've seen it so many times, I don't even know. It's hard to be objective.
No,
you
it's
know?
Really, it's really
no,
weird.
But you get it right away. You're like, oh, I got it. You're following the board. Like, this is a legendary board, and just hearing, you know, but like I said, you could do a whole documentary on any one of the bands that you talk to, but just, it's not only a walk through Sound City and the board and, you know, what, like, Joe and Keith and those guys did, but also just, like, it is a trip through music.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was fucking, like, the movie flew by for me. So
oh, good.
I
okay.
really, yeah. I really hope people
Well, you know,
watch
that's
it.
The thing is that almost every studio in the world could have a movie like Sound City. And if everybody appreciated those places, I think the way that they deserve to be appreciated, like fucking churches or museums, there'd be, like, I think a deeper understanding or appreciation for music, because music can seem sort of transparent sometimes. It's a sound that comes through your car. It's a sound in an elevator. Or it's a fucking thing you see on TV. But at the end of the day, it really is people playing with other people. And that's what inspires other people to do it. You know,
And
you know what inspires a 12-year-old kid to pick up a guitar and play is seeing another 12-year-old kid do it. So if you show a human being that it's actually human beings making music, well, then maybe it'll inspire them to fall in love
with
it. And
I think that's the sort of underlying thing that I took away. And I think what the board represents is like humanity, like it's the humanity and the imperfection and the, like, just the being in the moment of it all. And so I hope people, is it coming out in theaters or people buy?
We're doing a little theater release, I think, and then you can go to our Sound City movie site, and it's the iTunes thing, and, you know, B-O-B. I'm not a businessman, I just fucking play music.
All right, Dave Grohl, thank you so much being here in your own studio.
Shout out
thank
to
you.
Rehab.
Thanks for
Rehab.
Sorry, Rehab. Sorry, I'll send you a hat or a shirt or something. Let's get a fruit basket or Rehab ASAP.
Dave Grohl, just send me a hat.
Rehab's hit song "Fuck You in the Face," Dave Grohl, is sweeping the nation.
Oh, no. Rehab.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the 65th National Finals of Distinguished Young Women.
Every year, one girl from every state leaves her family, her whole life behind, for 2 weeks and spends each day training, practicing, preparing. Because to win this competition, she needs to wow a panel of judges with her academic record, her athletic ability, her speaking skills, and a show-stopping talent.
I met her and I was like, she's going to win.
I wouldn't say I have an ego problem, but I'm extremely competitive.
When I sing that song about being a black woman in America, there's going to be backlash about that.
Oh, I'm just so happy. So happy.
I don't want to see them. I don't want to talk to them.
And then we stayed with them for the next year, unpacking just what happened those 2 weeks in Mobile. I'm Shimol Yai, and from Pineapple Street Studios and Wondery, this is The Competition. Follow The Competition on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to The Competition early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.